I got that sunshine in my pocket. Got that good soul in my feet. I feel that hot blood in my body when it drops.
Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Orla.
And I'm Andrea. Coming up on the show today, we're going to take a trip through Australia with travel journalist Jim Byers, who just recently got back from vacation there. And we're going to speak with Dr. Diliello from Cardiogenics Medical Center about children and nut allergies.
But first, did you actually know that Montreal has a pet ambulance? Well, joining us now is Rodney McLean, founder and owner of K911 Ambulance Service. Welcome to the show, Rodney.
Thank you.
So do tell us, what services does K911 primarily offer?
Well, we offer a host of different things to pet owners. The number one thing we offer would be ambulance service, whether your pet be hit by a car or you know, you have an emergency. And sometimes it's an owner emergency where the animal is hurt and the owner becomes fearful of the animal due to, you know, the circumstance. So there's that. And we also do home euthanasia, which is really important.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I'm sure a lot of people must feel much better, you know, having that take place in the comfort of their home for both themselves and for their
Absolutely.
Pet. So what type of animals do you cater to, Rodney?
Oh, it's a host of different types of animals, right down to cats, dogs, snakes, rabbits, birds. You know, we've been called for a hamster, euthanasia for a hamster.
Does it have to be a pet, or could this, you know, would somebody call you if they were to, I don't know, see a bird in distress that maybe, you know, is a wild animal?
We tend to put that more to the SPCA. They're more designed to take care of those things. But if there's no reply at the SPCA and the animal's life is in danger or is being abused, which we see quite a few times, they can give us a call for sure. We'll do what we can.
I remember telephoning K911. It must have been about, I would say, 12 years ago now, Rodney, for my Labrador, Lulu. She was at a daycare. She was vomiting like crazy. I think I was actually at the radio station at the time, and I couldn't get to the daycare. And I called your service, K911 Ambulance. You guys rushed over there. You took her. You know, you put her on the stretcher, you took her to the emergency, and then once everything was okay, you actually brought her back again. Talk us through what happens if someone has an emergency and they need a pet ambulance.
So the number one rule I always tell a pet owner is you're the best person to judge the health of your pet. That's number one. Number two is if we can't be, well, look, animals in Quebec don't have the same law, same rights as our human counterparts. So what happens is we're not allowed to go through stop signs, go through red lights. We're not allowed no sirens, no nothing. So what happens most of the time is we end up helping the client over the phone. You know, we stay on the phone with them until they get to the animal facility or the clinic of their choice. But if they can wait for us, we'll certainly do so. But we never tell someone to hold off on medical care to wait for us.
So in the event that you are picking up a pet to transport it, is it brought to the vet of the, you know, of the client's choice? Or is it brought, you know, to, I guess, like the DMV, let's say?
It's always brought to the vet of the client's choice for sure. But say, for instance, if we have like a lot of bleeding or we believe there's some type of internal injury or a torsion of the stomach, we will try to guide the client to say, hey, listen, this place is close. Let's go here. We'll stabilize and then we'll move into, you know, the choice where you want to be. Our main focus is to save the life of the animal.
You're listening to Now Trending. I'm Orla alongside Andrea, and we are chatting with Rodney McLean, owner and founder of K911 Pet Ambulance Service. So can I ask you, Rodney, how much does it typically cost to call out the ambulance and have the ambulance take the pet to the emergency?
Typically on the island. Yeah, on the island of Montreal, it's typically around $219, between $219 and $249, depending on where they are.
Okay.
Yeah. And as I said, you know, we have vets that do home euthanasia.
And what would...
I
was just going to ask you what that would cost.
The home euthanasia, it always depends on the vet's prices. But usually it's much more affordable if you go to the clinic itself, for sure. But usually you're looking at anywhere between $400 to $500, ballpark, give or take.
Right.
Yeah.
And can you give us any fabulous, lovely success stories? You know, because I know you've been in business for a very long time, Rodney. Can you give us a nice story?
Could it be a not nice story with a very happy ending?
Absolutely.
Yes.
We love a happy ending.
Yes.
So we were called to an animal that was in the middle of a domestic abuse. The husband came home and he was arguing with the wife, and the little chihuahua got up to defend her, and in the process got severely hurt. And the woman who had no means to take care of this animal, the vet bill was in the thousands. The little old man who lived across the street offered to pay the whole thing for her. And I think he paid upwards of $13,000. So every day we see people that just extend their hand out to an animal in need and a lost animal. And it's absolutely heartwarming. Because we see the brutal side of pet owners, but we see a wonderful side as well.
So did the neighbor call your ambulance service when this happened and you guys came out to take the chihuahua to the hospital?
Right. That's exactly what happened. The dog was laying out in the front yard and he was concerned for this dog's health and safety. So he called us out and we went, and we initially went in and spoke with the owner first and got her permission. And then we attended to the dog.
Wow.
And this little guy who could hardly even walk, he got in the back seat with us and he just paid the whole shot for her.
You're talking about the neighbor now, not the little guys in the dog, right?
Yeah, the neighbor.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's hope the woman is also okay in this situation.
Yes.
Totally.
Yes.
She absolutely was.
Excellent.
And I think the pet got hurt through, you know, just being jostled around. There was no physical violence except for the accident which happened to the pet.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Rodney, what areas do you cover? I know, obviously, the island of Montreal. Do you go further afield as well?
Yeah, we go North Shore, South Shore. Basically, if you're somewhere far out there, like sometimes we even go to Quebec City, if there's a certain need to have the animal brought in to see a specialist.
And just I'm also very important. How do people get in touch with you in the event that, you know, God forbid they do need your services?
Well, we're online and we're associated with just about every clinic on the island of Montreal. So anytime somebody says transport is needing or ambulance or euthanasia, they can get in contact with us.
So, Rodney, the important number I have here to call K911 ambulance is 514-677-4357.
Yes,
you also have
exactly
a website with a list of all the services that you offer, which is k911transport.com.
That's it.
So, and is there always somebody on the other end of the phone? How does it work when people call your number?
So we used to be open 24 hours a day due to our friend, Mr. COVID. We've held back our hours from 8 in the morning to 10 o'clock at night.
Okay. Okay.
So in between that, we can't answer the phone. We will answer the phone. We will guide you the best way we can. We'll do searches for if you need a clinic close to you. But yeah, that's our new hours.
Rodney, thank you so much for joining us today. And I just love this service. I've used it before. And I was very appreciative of the pet ambulance service you gave me. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Rodney McLean, the owner and founder of K911 Pet Ambulance. Again, the number is 514-677-4357, or you can go on their website where you will find the number and see the list of services they offer at k911transport.com. Coming up, let's take a trip to Australia, everybody, with travel journalist Jim Byers. But first, let's see how the roads are doing.
Welcome back. I'm Andrea, along with Orla. So Australia, it's the world's sixth largest country. It's also the oldest, flattest, and driest inhabited continent. And it is a mega diverse country, and its size gives it a wide variety of landscapes and climates, with deserts in the center, tropical rainforests in the northeast, tropical savannas in the north, and mountain ranges in the southeast. There's so much to see and do, and if you're thinking about planning a trip, it might be daunting to know where to start. So if you're fancy taking that vacation to Australia, what would it look like? Joining us now is travel journalist Jim Byers, who just got back from Australia. Welcome back, Jim.
Thanks, Ed. How are you?
Yeah, we're good. We're good. So Australia, listen, I've been there myself, had a wonderful, wonderful few weeks there, probably over 10 years ago, but I would love to go back and see more. So tell us, I know you were recently there, so tell us a little bit about your trip and what you would recommend for somebody visiting maybe for the first time.
Yeah, boy, oh boy. I mean, it's you're right. It's such a vast country. It's like, not quite as large as Canada, but it's pretty darn close. And, it's 5 hours across the country. So, one of the issues I love Western Australia in particular, but it's another 5 hours from Sydney, and I find a lot of Canadians, they kind of get to Sydney, maybe Melbourne, and maybe up to like the Barrier Reef, but they don't often go further west, and I think you're really missing a lot of that. I mean, I think I wasn't there on my most recent trip, but I think if you don't go to Uluru, or what used to be called Ayers Rock, in the what's called the Red Center, I honestly think, Andrea, and I think it's kind of the essence of Australia. It's a very spiritual place, very important to the Aboriginal people. It's the oldest human culture on the planet. I think something like 40,000 years or maybe even more that people have been living in Australia. It's a sacred place to them. And, when you stand at the bottom of that red rock there at Uluru, and especially at sunrise or sunset, it is just beyond magical. It's a really, really special place. But, the cities are great. Obviously, Sydney speaks for itself. Everybody knows about the Harbour Bridge, the Opera House, the Great Barrier Reef up in Queensland is great. And, my recent trip was in a little bit of time in Sydney. I was at the new W Hotel, which is really spectacular. But I had 4 days in Tasmania and I think 8 days or something in Western Australia, which I just, like I said a minute ago, I just love Western Australia. A lot of Aussies never get there, but it's a really terrific place.
So I have to say, we hummed and hawed when we were booking our trip to Australia about going to Uluru. And, because it is a bit, it's a decent amount of, you have to fly there. And, it really is. But it's so interesting because, we went from Sydney to Uluru and it's just so different, which is so cool when you're visiting one country. You go from this hustle and bustle of the city to this absolutely beautiful part of the country. And we had a wonderful experience. So let's say you're in Australia for 2 weeks, would you recommend, Jim, doing that then?
I think so. I think it's a really, I think it's important. I think given, all the problems of the world these days, whenever we can honor Aboriginal cultures, Indigenous culture in Canada, I think that's an important thing to do. I do think it is, as much as I love Sydney, as much as I enjoyed Melbourne when I was there years ago, they're great cities, but they are at the final analysis. They're cities. We all, most of us live in cities: Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, whatever it may be, New York, and they're great cities. But when you get out to the outback, it is so utterly unlike anything we have in Canada. I mean, you could argue, I guess, in some ways, it's kind of similar to parts of Utah or Arizona, New Mexico, kind of that area. But it's just such a strongly spiritual kind of place, and it's really kind of hard to imagine the peace really that you feel when you go to a place like that, and the smallness that you feel when you're standing surrounded by this giant monolith, and you realize how important it is to local peoples. It's a very overpowering experience.
You're listening to Now Trending. I'm Orla alongside Andrea, and we are chatting with travel journalist Jim Byers about his recent trip to Australia. So, Jim, tell us about the weather conditions, and what would you say is the best time of year to go for anyone thinking about a trip to Australia?
Well, it can get pretty hot in their summer, which is, of course, our winter. So it's a nice combination for Canadians to get away.
it can get a little bit, you know, get a little warm in Melbourne and Sydney, especially in January, February. You know, we often see those, you know, temperatures when the Australian Open is being played. So I would say kind of a little bit of the shoulder seasons is going to be a bit more affordable, probably not quite as busy. So to me, I would say, you know, October, early November are really nice. And then again, March, April, you know, really nice times of the year. You're kind of fed up with the snow in Canada. You get down there, it's their fall, but it's still, you know, beautiful weather in most of the places that the tourists are going to be going.
So, Jim, I mean, as we mentioned, you know, it is such an enormous country. If you are there for a few weeks and you're looking to travel around a little bit, what would you recommend as the best way to get from place to place?
I think you almost need to fly. I mean, the territory is just so huge. I mean, you can drive not too badly from Sydney to Brisbane in a day or two. You can drive down to Melbourne in a day or a bit. Maybe stopping in Canberra, the capital, and seeing some nice little coastal villages or inland mountains and that sort of thing. But certainly if you're going to go to Tasmania, you can't drive to Tasmania because it's an island. So that certainly requires a flight, but it's only about an hour from Melbourne and a couple hours from Sydney. You know, Hobart is a really, really cool little city in the capital of Tasmania. And I think one of the travel magazines recently named it like the coolest city in all of Australia, which I'm sure sent the people in Sydney and Melbourne, you know, spinning. But it's a very, really cool city. I can't even begin to describe it, Orlando. There's a museum there called the Museum of Old and New. It was Old and New Art, Mona. It was built by a guy who made his fortune gambling and at the racetrack, and he's kind of an interesting, quirky kind of guy. But it's all underground. Almost the entire museum is like carved into the rock, a few miles from downtown Hobart. And there's things I can't even begin to describe on a family radio station that I just can't even tell you about.
You piqued our interest.
Oh no, it's completely crazy. There's like a human digestive machine that replicates. Anyway,
fair enough.
Oh yeah, there's religious art. There's like atheistic art. There's automobile parts. There's live music. It's just a really spectacular place. Any readers, listeners, I really admire. I would suggest that you go online, just Google some images and read a little bit up on Mona in Hobart. So that's really cool. There's beautiful, really good food and wine in Tasmania. Freycinet National Park is spectacular. Wine-Gas Bay is really one of the prettiest spots. But I just got to tell you one brief thing that I did recently on my trip in Western Australia, which is really maybe one of the coolest things I've ever did. It was a flying pub crawl.
What?
So think about that.
Wow.
Yeah. I flew from Perth, which is a really cool city, down to a town on the south coast of Western Australia called Esperance, maybe 18,000 people. But what you do is you get in a little plane, about a little 5-6-seater plane, and you fly over the Esperance Airport. There's these beautiful pink lakes all around the place. So any Barbie fans, take note, beautiful pink lakes. And then you head along the coast. And oh my God, you guys, the coast of Western Australia, especially down around Esperance, it's utterly spectacular. The white sand, purest white sand beaches I maybe have ever seen, turquoise, blue, aquamarine, every shade of blue and green water. You can see just crystal clear right up against these white sand beaches, and there's nobody there. I mean, I was there 2 weeks before the start of summer. A couple of the more popular beaches might have had, you know, 50 or 100, 200 people there. Most of them completely deserted. So this plane, to get back to the pub crawl, the plane takes off. You go over the pink lakes, you go over the islands and the beaches, and then you land at a dirt airstrip. So the pilot comes in and he has to scare off the kangaroos and the cattle on the dirt airstrip. So he flies low, scares them off, does a circle around, then you land on the little dirt airstrip. You get out. They take you over to a really cool pub. Just outside of Esperance. So we went there for lunch, had great fish and chips, had a beer, of course, not the pilot, just the passengers. So then it's unbelievable. They take you back to the plane, you hop in the plane again, you fly around, they see some more areas along the coast, then you land at another airstrip, and then they take you to a brew pub for lunch for another beer. So you have a beer over at the brew pub, and then you get back in the plane, and then you fly back to the airport, and then they took us in a short 5-minute ride to a really cool pub called Gibson Soak, and we went there and had another beer and talked to the locals and sat under this beautiful shady tree and then went back into town.
Oh, so, my goodness. That sounds so cool. I would need those drinks, Jim, I think, to get in that little plane.
I know.
Yeah, no, I'm not crazy about little planes. I'm really not. And I found, I hadn't really thought about this, but when you're over the land, it can get a little bit lumpy, especially if it's pretty hot. It wasn't very hot there, so it was just a little turbulence. But over the land, over the water, absolutely nothing. Just pure and simple, smoothest air I've ever flown in. Really spectacular. Wow.
Well, listen, it sounds like a really cool experience, and it sounds like you had a wonderful trip. I wish we had more time to talk about it, but Jim, thank you so much for joining us and telling us all about
Australia. We'll do it again anytime, guys.
Absolutely.
Great. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too. That's travel journalist Jim Byers. You can follow him and all of his travel adventures on Instagram at Jim Byers Travel 1. Coming up, is your child allergic to nuts? We're going to chat with the doctor about how to protect your kids now that some of schools are starting to ease nut regulations in the schools. But first, the latest from the CTV Montreal newsroom.
Welcome back. I'm Orla alongside Andrea. Now, for years, peanuts and tree nuts, they've been considered off limits in school snacks and lunches as a precaution protecting those with life-threatening allergies. It's a practice that many families with food allergic kids consider crucial. However, times are changing. And I found this out when my daughter came home recently and said that one of her friends beside her at lunch was eating pistachios. So I you know, my concern levels started to get heightened as my daughter has a tree nut allergy. So I you know, called the school and realized that codes of practice are actually being eased in support of people's freedom of choice. So how can we make sure kids with allergies are safe at school? Well, joining us now is Dr. DiLiello from Cardiogenics Medical Center. Welcome back, Dr. DiLiello.
Thank you so much.
So what do you think about the easing of the nut rules in schools?
Gosh, you know, it's such a tough situation to navigate. You know, as a physician and as a parent, I kind of have mixed feelings on this one. You know, on the one hand, I know that even in the most strictly controlled settings like hospitals and laboratories, it's impossible to guarantee an allergen-free environment. You know, with the different allergens, there's cross-contamination, human error. You know, in schools being what they are, I think it's impossible to have an allergen-free school environment, you know, nut ban or not. If we think about it, you know, nut allergies are present in about 5% of school-age children. But then combined, you know, fish, egg, and milk represent about another 5% of school-age children. So probably on a population level, you know, a broader approach aimed at education or reducing exposure to allergens would be more effective. But, you know, on the other hand, as a parent, I know every time you drop off your kid at daycare or school or a friend's house, you know, you basically want to know that they're safe. You want to know that nothing's going to harm them. And, you know, I apologize if this is triggering for some listeners, but I've heard some parents say that, especially, you know, those that have kids with multiple serious allergies, that it feels like everyone around their child's just walking around with a loaded gun. So it's a really tough situation to navigate. Maybe there's a hybrid solution, you know, for the very young children where preventative measures like hand washing and seat allocation, you know, don't really work well. Maybe there a specific ban could be more effective. But as I mentioned, it's really a tough situation to navigate.
It's interesting. So my son's school it's a nut-free environment. You know, you're not allowed to walk into the school with anything with even a trace of nuts in it.
Yeah.
But he also has kids, you know, in his class and in the school who have severe dairy allergies or severe egg allergies that could have the same impact if they were to come into contact. However, those are not off limits. So,
yeah.
But I think it seems that the kids with the allergies are so accustomed to managing them and being so hyper aware of it that they kind of take care of it on their own. So what do we need to be more aware of when it comes to allergies and protecting kids with any sort of allergy?
Yeah, I think you said it. I mean, education is key here. You know, there are certain guidelines, actually, you know, the public health specialist in Montreal just came out with a set of guidelines in 2020, specifically for schools in Montreal and looking specifically at elementary schools, and basically guidelines that the school, the staff, and the students should be following, you know, to help manage food allergies. So, you know, there's strategies, you know, adequately identifying all the students with allergies, making sure that that information is disseminated to all of the school employees, you know, making sure that we're raising awareness for the severity of food allergies, whether it's, you know, through like general assemblies, you know, having the nurses come into the classrooms and explain some of the signs and symptoms. You know, there's standardized letters that could be sent out as well to the parents in the classrooms to let them know, you know, how they could be, how they could add to the safety measures. The guidelines are quite good. They're available with online on Allergy Quebec. And there's even measures like in terms of how often, you know, staff should be taught about, you know, like training in terms of how to approach an allergy and how to manage it adequately, you know, make sure that there's protocolized like emergency measures. I think the more that we could prepare, the safer, you know, our kids will be for sure.
You're listening to Now Trending. I'm Orla alongside Andrea, and we are chatting with Dr. Di Liello from Cardiogenics Medical Center about the easing of some of the nut allergy rules in our schools. So, Dr. Di Liello, can you actually talk us through a reaction when a child does eat something they are allergic to?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in general, the food allergies, they could cause many different symptoms. There would be a range, you know, from mild to serious, typically to very serious. Typically, the symptoms will start within a few minutes up to a few hours after exposure to the allergen. You know, a mild reaction could look something like rash. There could be, you know, tingly feeling around the lips, a runny nose, a little bit of dizziness as well. In very small children, it's a little bit harder to identify. Sometimes it's just a lot of crying or an episode of diarrhea following ingestion of the allergen. And then the more severe reactions, of course, we're talking about anaphylaxis. So anaphylaxis, by definition, involves more than one organ system. So it could be the skin, like a rash, like hives, plus the respiratory system. So there will be some shortness of breath, throat swelling, difficulty breathing. Then it could also involve, let's say, the respiratory system and maybe the GI system. So then they'll get vomiting or diarrhea. It could also involve our vascular system. So it could even look like someone fainting. And that's, yeah, that could be life-threatening.
I just want to jump in because I don't want parents with kids with nut allergies panicking. This is not being eased in all schools. It's just some schools, you know, Orla's school, Orla's child's school in particular.
Right.
Dr. Di Liello, you know, when we were kids, my mom used to send me to school with a peanut butter sandwich every day. And it wasn't like, I mean, I know one adult with a nut allergy. Why is it? Do we have any idea why it has become so common for kids to have these allergies nowadays?
It's a good question. So, I mean, generally speaking, we don't know why allergies are increasing globally. We see that they are. One of the leading theories, and maybe some of the listeners are familiar with it, it's called the hygiene hypothesis, which is basically the idea that, you know, our kids are growing up with without being exposed to enough germs. Germs are really important, you know, to help the immune system know what's harmful and what's harmless. And so we see it amongst kids that are growing up, you know, in farms or kids that grow up with multiple older siblings, that they tend to have less allergies. So there might be a component of that. You know, there's also ideas about the exposure timing of allergies. So, for example, with nuts, basically, rather than avoiding nuts for the first year of life, actually introducing them early and frequently seems to help. So that's something that we recently changed in terms of what we tell parents. And then there are other theories, you know, looking at the role of vitamin D, looking at like the way that food is being processed and manufactured now, that may also play like a little role in that.
Dr. Di Liello, what are your thoughts, you know, as a general practitioner, scientific based, what are your thoughts on the easing of these nut rules in schools?
Yeah, so I think it has to be flexible. We can't 100% rely on a nut ban to give us that sense of security. I think, we have to follow the guidelines in terms of just reducing exposure, but also making sure that the area is clean, there's hand washing, that everyone's on board with the protocol and what to do in the case of an emergency. So I think that would be sort of a more effective strategy. But maybe in the younger kids, like having an all-out ban might be a little bit more effective where those measures, where we can't really rely on those other measures.
Dr. DiLiello, thank you so much for your input today. Really appreciate you taking the time to join us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
That's Dr. DiLiello from Cardiogenics Medical Center. Coming up, the frenzy in Montreal that I experienced from two reality TV stars. But first, let's take a look at the roads.
Welcome back. I'm Andrea, along with Orla. So, Orla, let me ask you a personal question. Do you feel lonely? Well, I guess we all feel lonely, but in general, would you say you feel lonely?
No.
Me neither.
Unfortunately, I'm too busy to feel lonely.
Yeah, I think, we're also kind of in the thick of it, right? We have youngish kids and we have a lot going on, and we're, I guess, in jobs that do require us to socialize quite a bit. But I know we keep hearing people talking about this loneliness epidemic. And I know right before the holidays, there was a survey, and apparently 34% of Canadians have reported feeling lonely and somewhat isolated. And there was some data that caught my eye last week that I thought was interesting. This survey was done in particular of Americans, but I feel like a lot of this could apply here as well. These Americans, especially young Americans, are feeling anxious about their lives and depressed and feeling somewhat isolated and have decreased socializing so much. Now, listen to this. From 2003 to 2022, the average of face-to-face socializing decreased by men in the United States by 30%. For unmarried Americans, more than 35%, and for teenagers, more than 45%. Boys and girls, ages 15 to 19 reduce their weekly social hangouts by more than 3 hours a week. Apparently the average time that Americans spend with their pets has roughly doubled in the past 20 years, both because more people have adopted pets, but also because they spend more time with them at home. In 2003, the typical female pet owner spent much more time socializing with humans than playing with their cat or dog. And by 2022, this has flipped, and the average woman with a pet now spends more time actively engaged with her pet than she spends hanging out face to face with fellow humans on any given day. It goes on.
That is incredible.
Crazy, eh? Women in 20-somethings have the most social time in a given week. Low-income, middle-aged, unmarried men have the lowest amounts of in-person social time. And teens and young adults saw by far the largest dip in socializing, especially since 2010. The groups with the largest increase in phone use also saw the largest declines in hanging out with friends. And this goes on and on. And it's just, it's so, I don't know. I was just really struck by this because I think it's easy to get bogged down. And it's nice, our phones and social media is a nice way to stay in touch with people. But really, nothing replaces that face-to-face interaction and that time spent. And for me, it was a good reminder to get out of the house a little bit more. Because I look back at growing up, we would go for coffee, my girlfriends and I, almost every night, even on school nights. And I don't know, does this still happen?
Well, I mean, no wonder there's a huge mental health crisis going on if everybody isn't socializing. There are so many positives to getting out there, being with other people, not just for your character, for your well-being. But I think with the increase of the iPads and all the technology, I mean, a lot of kids, they stay in their own homes on the technology playing together.
And it also,
instead of going out and playing with each other.
Well, that's it. And it's also, I think even as adults, like socializing is awkward if you don't do a lot of it, right? Like think about like the friend you haven't seen in a while and like you all of a sudden sit down and like it is a bit awkward and uncomfortable. But once you push past that, the benefits are huge.
They are. But I think that technology is playing a huge part in it. And I think that's a big issue. I think technology is an issue.
It is. And it's
not,
also,
it's not helping.
We're giving technology to kids so young too, right?
Yes.
And it's, anyways, it was just, the numbers really struck me and it was, you know, a good reminder. So let's have coffee soon in person, please.
Yes.
But speaking of socializing, the exact opposite end of the spectrum, you recently were out and about in quite the frenzy.
Quite the frenzy. So I was actually in Old Montreal, beautiful restaurant called Pangea Restaurant. And it was beautiful inside. It really, the decor is like an oasis with trees and plants inside. The food was fantastic. But there were two reality TV stars, Tom Schwartz and Jax Taylor from Vanderpump Rules, showed up. I've never experienced the frenzy, the pushing, the shoving, the screaming, the telephones, the pictures, the flashing. It was next level. And, you know, they did actually post how much love they had from Montreal, from the people, how much they loved the food and the restaurants here. And they really said Montreal made a huge impression on themselves and they couldn't wait to get back. They really found it was a city with so much love for them and so much culture. They absolutely loved it here. And Montreal, I mean, I was one of these girls in the frenzy.
Of course you were.
As soon as I got my pictures and my, hey, how are you? We interviewed you on your show. How are you doing? I didn't remind him that my geography was completely off though.
That's all right. That is all right. But it's so funny. So you're a mega fan, right, of the show?
Yes.
And
yes.
Like, you know, a mega fan of these two guys. I, on the other hand, until, you know, we interviewed them, really did, you know, I've never seen the show. And when I posted that, you know, that we were interviewing Jax last week on the show, or like the amount of messages I got from people, like my friends, like people that I, like acquaintances, people freaking out about these guys and like the mega, mega, mega fans of the show. But, you know, it's also nice because they were lovely, right?
They were very nice guys and they were more than happy to spend time with every single female in there to take a photo. Very polite, very charismatic, very friendly. You know, sometimes you think these reality TV stars, they are too hoity-toity, way above themselves to like come down to the ground and chat to their fans. These two guys, I have to say, Jax Taylor, Tom Schwartz, loved them even more. Loved them.
So nice loved to hear. Them. So nice
yeah.
to hear.
And so you and I have to go back because we were invited by Jax Taylor to go to his bar called Jax's Studio City, which happens to be
in Studio City. We can't say no to that. I mean, road trip, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for spending part of your Sunday with us. We'll be back at the same time next week. In the meantime, you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Now Trending Show. Have a fabulous week.